Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com, and a segment we like to call Dave's Got Guests, actually a special guest, who is the doyen, the diva, I hesitate to say mistress, but more like hostess of cabaret in New York City for quite a few years now. She has been kind of the person to turn to coordinate all these events and benefits, and she has a cable show all to do with cabaret singers and cabaret stars. And her name, if you haven't guessed by now, is Jamie DeRoy, and she is on the telephone with us right now. Jamie, thank you for joining us on Dave's Gone By.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, Jamie, first of all, you've got two different things in the hopper. You've got something happening on February 24th, and you also have a CD. Why don't we start with the disc first? It's called Animal Tracks, Volume 5. So I guess there were four of these before now. What's it all about, Jamie?
Well, I've been doing this series of CDs, and they all have themes, and the first two were on taking you back to your childhood, and then we did a Christmas holiday kind of an album, and then the last one was on family relationships, and then I just decided, because I love the Humane Society so much, that we would do a special CD for them, all animal songs, with the proceeds going to them, and they are just the most delightful people to work with, and I mean, going up to the Humane Society, even in their offices, they have a lot of the dogs and cats running around and just sort of working with them in the office. It's a great place to work, I'll tell you.
because is it all, I mean, cats and dogs, or do they have all sorts of weird, bizarre,
I think they have a lot of weird animals there. They have a little hospital there, too, where people can bring their pets for checkups and to get spayed, and I think that they are, you know, probably a low-cost group because they encourage spaying of animals, and, you know, I don't know what the costs and you know, the structure of all of that is, but whenever I go there, in the waiting room, there's always people waiting to get into the doctor's offices. Then just to see these adorable pets that, for one reason or another, have been dropped off and are looking for new homes. Sometimes it's as simple as somebody's gotten a pedigree dog, which is what happened just recently, where I think somebody was given a dog for Christmas, and it was a woman who just, she couldn't take care of it. It was a very spry, adorable little poodle, and she just couldn't handle it. So now the dog is up for adoption. But there's a million and one stories of why a cat or a dog would end up there.
One of the things is kind of interesting, the intro, the foreword in the booklet to the CD that you do recounts, it seems like you've had like 400 animals in your lifetime so far.
Well, I had a lot, and I mean, I tell you, at one point I had, in my first marriage, 8 cats, and at one point between two of the cats, one cat gave birth to 7 kittens and one to one, so at one point in this home we had, it was a big apartment, thank goodness, 8 cats and 8 kittens, but I was in heaven, I mean.
I thought it was like the single, you know, the single ladies who were supposed to have a bazillion cats, not the married ones.
No, I know. Isn't that bizarre?
So we'll talk about the CD in a little bit, but let's now get back more to your origins and how you became kind of so associated with cabaret in Manhattan. Where did that all start for you?
Boy, I don't know. You know, it's I had really started in the nightclub business before they even referred to it as cabaret, way, way, way back in the days of the living room, when around us were the Empire Room and the Persian Room and upstairs at the downstairs, and downstairs at the upstairs, and, you know, it just, I think, you know, we were kind of in the heyday then, or maybe it was just the end of that era. And when I kind of got back into singing in nightclubs, it's when Reno Sweeney was really in full throttle, and so I was doing clubs in those days, like Reno Sweeney and the original ballroom in Soho, and I don't know if you remember the Bushes in the Park Royal Hotel on West 73rd.
I remember Reno Sweeney's reading about it. I wasn't quite going to cabaret at the point when I would have gotten there.
Yeah, that was where, you know, Melissa Manchester and Peter Allen, I mean, that's where most of us really became familiar with them.
But you were a performer.
I was a performer, mostly a singer, really. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started working at places like Reno Sweeney and the Ballroom where I was suddenly not an opening act for a comic, because they always had a girl singer open for a male comic. And, you know, if there weren't as many female comics in those days. But it would always be a singer opening for a comic, and there was always at least two people on a bill. And at Reno Sweeney, they didn't always have an opening act, so sometimes you were the only act. And I just found my footing in those clubs in the sense of that I just was very comfortable talking to the audience, which is something I was never allowed to do when I was opening a comic, because you weren't supposed to talk to the audience, and you certainly weren't supposed to be funny in front of a comic in those days.
Right.
Now they're not as paranoid about it, but boy, they were then. And it just turned out I was quick on my feet and funny, and some agents from William Morris, Lee Stevens, who was the head of William Morris, and Lee Solomon, who was the head of the Variety Department, encouraged me to go more the comedic route. I never had the guts to do it full stand-up comedy. I think that's about the hardest thing you can do, truly.
Mm-hmm. So you were more, it evolved more into kind of a hostess.
Well, it started with just evolving into doing funny songs and special material and just being comfortable with an audience and talking to an audience. And then I used to throw annual 30th birthday parties, and I would always ask a few friends to come by and do my favorite thing that they did in their act, and I would, you know, usually do a song or two. I remember doing one at a place called Private Eyes on, I think it was West 22nd Street or something, very cool place, that Dallas Bosendahl, who was just a great party giver, had arranged for me, and I remember saying, it's my party and I'll sing if I want to, and that was the invite. And we had several guests perform, and so in 1990, I just kind of decided that it would be more fun and something different instead of just doing it once a year at a party, to do it as a series and to bring my talented friends on and let them do what they do. I mean, you know, a lot of people go to see other people's acts and they go, oh, I really like that song, I think I'll sing it. Well, I wasn't interested in learning it, and I figured I wouldn't do it as well as they did anyway, and why should I steal their material? I want to share their material. So I started, you know, it was kind of like a feeling of sharing my friends with my performer friends and kind of doing a crisscrossing of, you know. And it actually helped the performers in many cases because it broadened their audiences. But, of course, you know, a lot of the performers helped me, too, because a lot of the performers were, you know, pretty big names. So, they would help bring on that in the audience. They would help get us more attention and you know, it was always kind of a mix of a known performer with an unknown performer, which was kind of the exciting part of it. You know, it's like in the old days of Ed Sullivan, you'd get a star, but you'd get some variety act that no one ever heard of, but it was great fun.
And it also wasn't just like an unknown opening for 10 minutes for a known. They follow each other and kind of, there was sort of a star system, but it wasn't so calculated like that, because you would follow a star with someone that you never heard of, and then another star.
Right.
It was just whoever happened to be on next into a nice flow of an evening, and it's a rather egalitarian way to do things.
Right.
And then would you count, since over you know, really got into that part of it, things about back in 1990, can you point to certain performers that you semi-discovered that you kind of really pushed forward and said to everybody, hey, you know, check these folks out?
Well, Caroline Ray was certainly unknown when I used to have her on the show, and a lot of times I'd book her and she'd get some great job. I seemed to be a lucky, almost like a lucky coin for a lot of the performers that I'd book, and then they'd get a job, and they were always, you know, we always had an understanding if you get a paying gig that, you know, you just call and we'll replace you, don't worry about it. But it always brought them luck, and people like Caroline Ray, and I mean, even, I mean, Mario Cantone was always incredible, but when he was with me at Caroline's, when we did the show at Caroline's on Broadway, when they had moved uptown, Ron Delsener had come to check out the show, and he grabbed Mario and had him open for Shirley Bassey at Carnegie Hall, and that started him on a whole new, you know, role. And then he started playing Caroline's, which he had never done until, you know, my group show. So Peter Cincotti was with me when he was 15, 16, 17.
Oh, he's getting big now, yeah.
And it's always fun to find somebody that nobody else has found quite yet, or, you know, it's just from a different venue. I mean, in California, I had Bruce Valanche on, who was hysterical. And people have seen his words, have heard his words, because he's written for Bette Midler for the Academy Awards. He would, you know, write jokes backstage for Billy Crystal, but not everybody knew who he was. And to have him tell the stories of working with Bette Midler or working backstage at the Academy Awards or working with the Osmonds, it was just priceless. I mean, he is so funny. Now he's running around the country doing Hairspray in the Harvey Fierstein part.
Exactly. And I guess he took the idea also from when he was shaping his material in, you know, your cabaret slash variety shows. He even did an off-Broadway solo show.
Right. This was actually, when I had him on, it was before he did that. And he had just one day decided to get up and do a little stand-up at Caroline's, and I just thought he was hysterical. I mean, I knew him from we would have lunch every once in a while, and I just was always wanting to work with him, and it just never really panned out, but he just was funny. And you could call his answering machine, and he would change it every day with a really, really funny message. So when he came on my show in California, I really thought he wanted to just do some, you know, stand-up, like 8-10 minutes like everybody else does. And he said, nah, I just want to sit and talk. Well, we sat on the stage, and because I knew a lot about his stories and his life, I knew a lot of questions to ask to guide him into some of the funniest stories you've ever heard. And, you know, we spoke for like 26 minutes solid. I never spend that much time with one guest, but it was just too funny to stop it. And he was the last guest, and, you know, you could tell by feeling it and looking out in the audience that they were with us, that we weren't losing them. If we were losing them, I would have cut it. But we weren't losing them, so we just kept going with it, and it was just the most fun. And, of course, then I cut it into a wonderful, you know, television show, just him.
Wow. Well, speaking of, why don't you let our audience know where they can catch your show?
Well, first of all, it's on every other Tuesday on PBS, on public television in Manhattan. It's on Manhattan Cable and RCN at 67 and 110. And it's a few places outside of the city carry it. But the live shows, we're doing the last Tuesday of every month at Dillon's on West 54th Street. So my next one, I compete with myself. I'm on television the same night I'm on stage. But Tuesday, February 24th at Dillon's, and some of my guests are Ann Steele, who's a wonderful singer, and Angela LaGreca, who...
Oh, gosh, yeah. She's been...
incredibly funny. She does some very funny songs, too, but she's just sitting talking or standing up talking. She's unbelievable. And Ray Jessel, who kind of stole the cabaret convention when he did his funny thing about Einstein, which he will do for us, and a new comic, Joe Bronzy. So, you know, we keep adding guests to the list. And Modern Man, who I don't know if you've ever seen them, but they are three of the funniest singer-songwriters that join together, and they are hysterical. It's David Buskin, Wurzbach, and Rob Carlson. Really, really funny group.
Actually, Wurzbach is on the CD for...
he does the snake song.
I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, I'm more of a theater person than a cabaret person, but even in my limited knowledge of that field, in the decade and a half or so that I've been out there reviewing shows and seeing things, I mean, I've seen Rainbow and Stars close, I've seen 88 go away, I've seen a Firebird. Is cabaret in, like, a difficult time now, or is it in a... Am I missing, like, a lot of clubs that I should be knowing about? Or where do you think the state of the art form is right now?
Well, you know, everything always goes through changes. I mean, when the living room closed, everybody thought, oh, my God, it's the end of an era. And upstairs at the downstairs closed. They had reviews downstairs, and or reviews actually upstairs and cabaret performers down. It's always sad when a club closes. But things go through an ever-evolving process. And it's true that we don't have the Persian rooms and the Empire rooms anymore or anything really quite like it. Although I guess the closest thing to those rooms would be Feinstein's at the Regency and the Algonquin and places like that. So, I mean, I always hate to see a club close, but it's just a matter of attrition. It's just going to happen. And I think things just change. I mean, when Reno Sweeney's, you know, came out of after an era when all these other kind of clubs closed, and when they were around, we thought, wow, this is it, you know. And then when Reno Sweeney's went off the radar, that was quite sad, too. But then you start seeing places like Don't Tell Mama popping up and down the line 88s. And it happens just because, you know, a landlord wants to raise the price of the space, and it's unaffordable to a club owner. So there usually a little bit of time happens, and then a new club appears. I mean, even like the King Kong Room closing recently.
Right.
They've
exactly.
moved so many of the venues that were going to be at the King Kong Room over to the Ars Nova Theater. Now, that is a space that existed already, but was really only existing on a rental basis here and there with a couple of off-Broadway or shows or an occasional cabaret thing. And now you hear about it all the time because it's really like there's something there every night now.
Well, that also leads to sort of a side question, and I assume you're in contact with the owners and producers at these clubs. Can a club make it? It's like, how does Don't Tell Mama do it and pay its employees and pay the rent and not take the money and run for its real estate?
Well, most of the places don't really, they don't own the spaces anyway. They rent. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, selling out. In the sense of, you know, somebody owned a building and somebody came by and said, you know, we'll give you $10 million for the building. I mean, they probably would go, you know, I'm never going to make that kind of money. If I stay here for the rest of my life, I'm taking it.
Right. Yeah.
But in most cases, they're renting the spaces.
That's why I think it's wonderful that Don't Tell Mama is still there, but it makes me wonder. It's right, you know, in the heart of 46th Street and rather large space. And I have a good crowd, but I wonder how much are they paying in rent and how do they swing it? I mean, selling drinks or a cover charge or what? Or,
well, I don't,
or
they don't make it on the cover charges for sure because the cover charges for the most part, you know, go to the performer and certainly the performers never make money in cabaret. Unfortunately, the performer these days, you know, bears a lot of the brunt of the expenses, certainly the production expenses. I'm not belittling the club because, believe me, they have rent and they have insurance and they have a staff to pay. So there's, you know, they've got their problems just like the performers have their problems. But, you know, how does a club ever make it? I don't know. I mean, you know, there are always different situations. Certainly Feinstein's or an Algonquin are really different situations. They're a whole different kettle of fish than, you know, than the smaller clubs. And I'm sure a lot of these rooms are hand-to-mouth. I mean, Don't Tell Mama is now not allowed to have two shows going on at the same time, which it always used to.
Ooh.
So they've had to reconfigure their space somewhat. And the piano bar earlier is a showroom, and then it becomes a piano bar after the show that's happened there. So they have a lot of spaces, but they can't utilize them to the extent that they used to, and I think because of fire laws, et cetera.
Mm.
But I think all these places have a tough time. I mean, I'm always happy for a club that, you know, that sticks around and keeps it going because I'm sure it's very easy to just say, you know, hey, we're not making enough and close the doors, you know. comedy clubs, you know, they have, I'm sure they have their same problems too. But they usually pay a minimal amount to the comics, and most of the cover charges are then do go to the club.
Right. Going from sort of negative question to a more positive one, thinking back in your years of attending performances, is there one moment that stands out where you went to a club and you saw a particular performer or a group of performers, and it was just a revelatory thing, like the greatest single moment you've ever had as a spectator in a cabaret situation?
Well, I probably had a lot of those. When I came in from Pittsburgh once on a vacation, I went to the Bitter End, and there was a group called the Big Three, which was Tim Harden and Cass Elliot before the Mamas and the Papas, and I forget the third person. And then also on the same bill was a group called Joan, Jake, and Jim, which was Joan Rivers, Jake Holmes, who's a wonderful songwriter, and Jim became a very, very big, very well-known comedy writer whose last name escapes me at the moment. But you know, you really saw something, you know, something really exciting. Or when I went down to see Reno Sweeney's and caught Peter Allen for my first time of catching him was just a revelation. And in the later days of Reno Sweeney's, when the clubs were all fighting the cabaret laws where you weren't allowed to have more than three people on the stage, if you didn't have a cabaret license, which also meant you could have dancing, so what cabaret had that kind of a license, you know? But they were trying to enforce this. They closed down Mikkel's Jazz Club because of it. I mean, they closed down a lot of places and made it a lot of trouble for places. It was a kind of an archaic law that was on the books that is now off the books, but at that time they were still fighting. Marcia Malamet, who's a wonderful songwriter, was doing a show, and if a piano player sang and played the piano, it counted as two people. And she had a backup singer. She had just written a song with Peter Allen, who was in the audience. So for us, it was a very exciting moment because Peter was in the audience. She kept screwing up the words, and he said, "Enough of this. You're not screwing up my song. I'm going to do it myself." And he came up onto the stage, and he went to the microphone and he sang it, which of course the audience is going, "Oh my God, this is fabulous. Peter Allen is doing his own song, brand new, you know, right hot off the presses." And the club owner is standing on the side going, "Please get him off the stage. There's more than three people now. I'll get a ticket." And, you know, it was always a kind of thing of you're fighting for different reasons. We wanted more of Peter Allen, and he just couldn't wait to get him off because he didn't want to get fined.
Well, just tell him to sing a cappella.
That's right.
You know, he could carry the maracas. He could do it. You know. And for those who are not familiar with that name, he is, of course, the character on whom The Boy from Oz is based, the big Broadway musical with Hugh Jackman playing Peter Allen. And, you know, just making sure that our listeners know some of the terrain that we've been covering here with Jamie DeRoy, who is, gosh, performer, producer, hostess, and guide. What would you call yourself? Term would you use? Well, producer,
yeah. Across the board. Yeah. I am a producer, and I've, you know, not only produced these things for TV and for live, you know, variety shows, but I've actually gotten involved with producing off-Broadway and as an associate producer on Broadway. I mean, it's something I would love to be able to do more of, but it's very tough. But I love putting, you know, people together, and I love having an audience discover new talent or revisiting, you know, some talent maybe that they are familiar with. I mean, we were quite lucky at the beginning of my run in 1990 when we started these shows. Steve Allen came to one of my shows. He'd been sending these parodies.
Yeah.
We were in touch by mail. Nobody had email then those days, you know, by mail and fax. He'd go, "Oh, I just wrote this new parody. Maybe you can try it." And he would just send me a parody. I didn't even know him. I just had written to him, and he was the nicest person on earth. And he shows up to catch my show, and having sent me a new parody, I said, I'd much rather you do it. You'll do it better. Why don't you come up on stage? And he did.
All right.
And so those are the kind of things where I'd say, you know, we had help from, you know, maybe it wasn't planned, but it worked out that way, you know, from some people that were a great boost to when we started. And Laverne Baker, God rest her soul. I mean, she had come and done a couple of shows with me. She's so funny. And, you know, to get her to get up and sing Tweedledee Dee, but even just having her talk on stage was priceless. And Dolores Gray. As a matter of fact, Dolores Gray, Laverne Baker, and Mario Cantone were all on the same show, and I had them all on the stage at the same time talking. It was just priceless. It was so funny.
Do you have tapes or footage of any of
this? You know, the one thing that I always did was I videotaped everything I ever did except one show at the ballroom that we thought, oh, it's the same cast, we don't really need it that night. But otherwise, I do have tape of everything from 1990. I mean, in my dreams, I kept thinking somebody from some major cable channel or a major station would come along and say, we got to put her on the air. Well, nobody did. And after a few years, Bradshaw Smith, who did all my videotaping, said, put yourself on. I was already on Cabaret Beat with him, and he had decided to drop Cabaret Beat for Broadway Beat.
Right.
And he said, you've got such great footage, and you keep doing this. Just do it on your own, and which is what I did. And I was very sorry to see Metro Arts 13 go under, because they played some of the shows, and it got us a wider audience, and it was very sad to see a cable station, you know, under a bigger umbrella than we were, not be able to make it.
Hmm. But at least you still have, like, the archival stuff. Are you ever going to release, maybe not on prepackaged videos or something, but you're doing CDs of new material. Have you thought about also doing this? As the years go by, it's going to get more and more valuable in just an aesthetic sense of putting out that material to the public.
I haven't thought about it. I would, you know, want to really double check, you know, how, you know, legally or morally right it is, you know.
Well, I mean, you still have to get the rights, I guess, from the performers that they were still alive. I mean, that yes, it's a headache, but...
Yeah.
Because
we have this footage, I mean, from time to time we'll do a show, Gone But Not Forgotten, and we've have people that have not necessarily all died, although some of them have, but some groups just disband, like
right.
JQ and the Bandits. They were a great group. I wish they were still around, but for whatever the reasons, you know, it's hard to keep a vocal group together when there's a lot of people with a lot of different schedules and personal lives, and so, you know, they disbanded, and but then, you know, I have people on tape like Bruce Hopkins doing some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen. And, you know, and this is the kind of stuff we have to remember him by, or Nancy Lamott, because they are gone, or Laurie Beachman, you know. They're not going to be able to come back and do it, so at least we can remember them in a fond way.
And you are creating new memories for people by releasing, well, by having your TV show and by releasing compact discs. And I'm going to remind folks that the most recent one is called Animal Tracks. It's volume 5 of this project, which is a benefit for the Humane Society. It's Jamie DeRoy and friends, and her friends include such quite talented people as Judy Barnett, Emily Skinner, Paige Price, Carrie Butler. She was in Hairspray, now she's in Little Shop on Broadway. Steve Ross, who's just marvelous. Marion Selby is kind of an odd person out there, and she does a spoken poem thing. And the wonderful Jay Rogers. Speaking of bartenders, I mean, he's a man who, while performing, is also bartending. I don't know if he still does it, but I remember seeing him in a show and then wandering into Don't Tell Mama, and there he was serving me a drink. It was really interesting.
Well, there's a lot of talented performers out there that, you know, that are, their day job is being a waiter, which is, you know, probably more lucrative and interesting than working in somebody's office.
True.
I mean, Jimmy Smigula, who's on it, was discovered by Rosie O'Donnell, and then he went on to be in a couple of Broadway shows. Right now he's touring with Phantom of the Opera. He has a beautiful voice, and that was just because she brought him up from the audience, and he sang a couple of lines a cappella, and he blew everybody away.
Man, that was one of those one in a million things.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're in the right place at the right time with the right people, but of course we spent the past 20 years getting to be in the right place at the right time with the right people.
Exactly.
Anyway, speaking of someone who knows how to do all that and get the right people together and being in this right place at this right time, I want to thank you so much, Jamie DeRoy, for being.
Anytime. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Likewise, good luck with your show on the 24th and every last Tuesday of the month at Dylan's Supper Club in, where is it exactly?
It's West 54th between 7th and 8th, right across from Studio 54. And, but, you know, there's really nothing better than live, as we all know when we go to the theater. It's quite exciting to see something live in front of your eyes. And there's nothing that will ever equal that.
Well, thank you, Jamie, for being live in front of our ears, and thank you for giving us so many good times and so much good music. Thanks again for coming.
Thank you, David, and thanks for all that you do.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.